several miles off the main highway, tucked away in a secluded canyon on prime vineyard property, stands a rustic barn that was built many decades before the vines around it were planted. In that barn, a sophisticated broadcast and recording studio has been built. The barn also has a well-hidden root cellar stocked with many of the world's most exceptional wines, only to be shared with guests who secretly come to offer their insights and tell their stories. Guests are sworn to secrecy and are shuttled to the studio aboard a John Deere tractor. Those who cannot make the journey in person are interviewed by satellite hookup, and sometimes the crew simply sneaks away with microphones in hand and interviews guests in barrel rooms, wine cellars, and other magical places. All of this is done like clockwork every single week, so that we can bring you another episode of Grape Encounters Radio.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow, talk to me.
At any given wine tasting, winemakers are eager to tell you about the subtle nuances, unique terroir, and meticulous care that went into making the wine that you're now swirling in your glass. What they probably will not tell you is what and how many legal additives went into making the final product. Now, I don't think anyone would be surprised to learn that an $8 bottle of wine purchased at the supermarket or package store had been tinkered with to achieve year-after-year continuity. But what about that $40 or $60 or $100 bottle of wine that seems so utterly perfect? Is that perfection the result of unparalleled winemaking skills and extraordinary fruit? Or, as they say in Hollywood, did the wine have a little work done? Pick up virtually any product in your grocery store, and the list of ingredients, particularly those you're unfamiliar with, are endless. Pick up a bottle of wine, and you will likely see the words, sulfites added, and that's it. Now, among those who think full disclosure in the wine industry is long overdue is Paul Draper, the chief winemaker and CEO of Ridge Vineyards. Paul is a true icon in the winemaking world. And those who love Zinfandel certainly owe Paul a debt of gratitude, as he's been a central figure in the elevation of Zin to the stature it enjoys today. Paul competed in the historic 1976 Judgment of Paris and won the rematch decades later. And Paul, it's a real privilege to have you on the line with us now.
Well, David, it's a delight to do it, The subject that you're proposing is one that is certainly dear to my heart.
Now, at Ridge, you guys are disclosing some pretty innocent things on your labels voluntarily. Are you aware of any winemakers that are doing that as well?
You know, I think there are a couple. And I think we tried to do it about 35 years ago. And the federal authorities who have to approve your labels 35 years ago said, absolutely not. It's not required. And no one does it. And we won't allow you to do it. And about 4 years ago, I saw that my friend Randall Graham had done something in this line. I am not sure just what it was or how complete, but it was a list of ingredients, and the feds allowed it to go through. So we immediately jumped in and said, okay, we're going to do this. It looks like they're going to allow it to be done voluntarily.
Paul, here's what I don't get. You've got alcohol that is so heavily regulated, and yet there's all this resistance when it comes to disclosure of ingredients. Yet when you pick up an item of food in the grocery store, every single ingredient is listed there. Why the double standard? I don't get it.
Well, let me go back in history just a little bit. When ingredient labeling first came in, the Fed said to everyone, including the wine, beer, spirits industry, this is what you're going to have to do. And a friend of mine who owned one of the leading small breweries sat on one of the national boards and so was in on the discussions. And in beer, where they had a long list of additives, foamers, defoamers, foam stabilizers, on and on, they said, okay, this is coming. We've got to look at this. And sure enough, they were able, at least as far as I know, 90% or more of the breweries were able to cut it down to basically none of those additives and clean their act up entirely because they assumed the thing was going to go through. The spirits and the wine industry fought it tooth and nail and succeeded, saying, we're dealing with a natural product. Unlike beer, where you can brew all year round and you can alter where you get your hops and your wheat and your rice, and they can adjust, we can't. Mother Nature gives us this product, and every year it's different. And so every single batch would have a different ingredient label on it. The analysis would just be beyond the means for not only the big guys, but the small guys as well. And they succeeded, and the feds backed off and allowed wine, spirits, and beer not to have to do that.
But you know, you said the analysis would be almost impossible to do, but you certainly know what you're dumping into the tank.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can say, you know, how did I stand on that initial thing? No, I personally think that way back then, you know, giving it a lot of time, something could have been done. Today, it is really, I won't say just controversial, but we're sort of in the position of saying, you know, because I couldn't have gotten through Davis, so I'm not an enologist. I'm a winemaker. And basically the techniques that I used and could deal with, could understand, were really the 19th century techniques that were used in California up through the 30s, right after Prohibition, and in Europe up until, the early 60s, mid-60s. And before all of the modern winemaking process machines, additives really came into full effect. Those I couldn't deal with. I was so lucky in having grapes at Montebello and then at Guysville, Lytton Springs, that made themselves with our guidance, what can I say, using nothing more than the few adjustments or additives that had been used for, I'd say back into the early 19th century or before.
What's amazing to me is the Montebello Cab that was in the Judgment of Paris comes in fifth, and then decades later in the rematch, it comes in first. How awesome.
It did. It came in first by 18 points, and it was 35 years old, and it was 12.2 alcohol. So I use that as an example that, in fact, if you want your wine to age, you shouldn't be making high alcohol wines. But in any case, yes, we knew that that was a fine wine and would develop fully over time, and sure enough, it did.
And you didn't need any additives to have it live a long life.
Exactly. That wasn't, the 71, it was my third vintage at Ridge, wasn't fine, wasn't even rough filtered at bottling, which is something we would do today. So it was absolutely natural yeast, natural malolactic, minimal SO2, and that was it.
A couple of weeks ago, I had Thomas Matthews on, the managing editor of Wine Spectator magazine, and they just came out with their top 100 wines for the year. And I broached the subject of additives in wine, and I asked him point blank, when you're tasting the wines for that competition, can you tell if anything has been added to the wine? And his remark was that blind tasting proves that you can't. It really scares me when the best of the best are not able to detect when a wine has literally been manufactured.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. Obviously, if anyone in tinkering with a wine has not done it with a light touch and with some real experience, you're going to be able to see it. And you know wines that you've tasted where you say, gee, there's something going on here that just doesn't look natural. And there are a number of wines in that category. Hopefully, some of the less expensive, not the most expensive. But it's true that there's no way, and let's put it this way, enology schools, and not just in this country, but in Europe as well, as my French friends, for example, have told me, their training tells them about everything that's available. That is, the full tool belt of additives and processing machines. Now, Europe, luckily, never went through Prohibition, so there is, in winemaking in Europe, this knowledge of traditional winemaking. And they know that all these new technological assists have happened more recently, and yes, the majority of them use them, but they also know that great wine, fine wine, can be made from really fine grapes without those. So there's that basic thing in Europe. We in this country, after Prohibition, we lost that tradition of winemaking, a straightforward, you might call it, winemaking, and just were immediately educated into modern technological winemaking. So all these guys that are making $100 bottles or $300 bottles, they've been trained that this is part of what it's about. You are a winemaker. In Europe, there's no such word. The closest you might say in England is vintner, but, you know, in France, Spain, Italy, so on, Germany, there's no word for putting you in the position of creator. It is the grapes that you're working with that produce the wine. in the New World, we use this word winemaker, which means we take these grapes and we make it. We're the creator into something that we've decided is the best. Whether it's a consensus of winemakers in a particular region that these are the wines they admire most and they're going to make those wines by taking the grapes and manipulating them to be what they want it to be. So it's really two different philosophies. The problem is that in Europe, the majority of people are doing the same thing. The small guys, the best guys, are not. But in this country, your training is that these are the tools, you should use them.
And we are talking with Paul Draper, the winemaker and CEO at Ridge Vineyards, one of my favorites, talking about the disclosure of additives that are put into your wine without you realizing it. Should it be on the label? Well, we'll continue this discussion in just a moment here on Grape Encounters Radio.
This is not just a wine show. This is Grape Encounters. Now, back to Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
A bottle of red, a bottle of whites. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want.
We're talking about the manipulation of wine with Paul Draper, one of the true icons of winemaking here in America, really in the world. He's the CEO and chief winemaker at Ridge Vineyards, one of my favorites. Paul, you know, I think back to when Lance Armstrong was stripped of all of his medals because he had earned them using steroids. And you look at all the wines that have gained a price advantage because they've won gold medals at this competition or that, or they've been named in major publications like Enthusiast or Wine Spectator as being exceptional wines. If we can't tell that they've been manipulated, should a wine be allowed to reap the benefits from these kinds of competitions without disclosing the fact that artificial ingredients or some manipulation has gone on there?
Well, yes. You know, I would vastly prefer that everyone give the grapes that they have the chance to really show what those grapes express. That is what their distinctive character is. Now, admittedly, probably the majority of vineyards, either because of high yields or simply because of the soil they're in, the climate that they experience, do not make themselves. That is, do not produce right. Something of the highest quality without a lot of help. And, you know, that's great. What I guess bothers me is that when, just as you say, those grapes of that quality or even fine grapes that are not given a chance to express themselves are made into something through manipulation. Now, you know, the whole idea of would mandatory ingredient labeling be possible for the wine industry, that is really tough. I mean, that's something that I'm not sure can come about. And yes, I'm a little put off by wines that sell for, let's say, high prices or have a high critical reputation that do not really express their vineyard and have been manipulated.
But right.
I personally think it should be voluntary, and that if the public, especially of the fine wines for which they're paying, or wines that attempt to be fine wines, for which they're paying a high price, I would like to see more of them voluntarily move back and put on the labels what they do. So I would agree that if it's something that's going to sell for a price, I'd like to know what's in that bottle.
Yeah, some of the people who have criticized you and others who have called for at least voluntary disclosure have said that the wines that are being most manipulated are being consumed by people who wouldn't care about the manipulation to begin with. You think that's,
well, you know, yeah,
is that true? That's true to a degree, I suppose.
Well, I guess, yeah, to a degree. And the wines, as I just mentioned, not everybody, although a lot more people have fine vineyards than they realize or, you know, anybody realizes. That is because they haven't really given them a chance with moderate yields and attempting to see what character their vineyard produces. But they've just taken the grapes and made it into what they want it to be. So there are many, many more really fine vineyards than we immediately recognize. But there are also, as I mentioned, a lot of vineyards, either through high yields or simply where they're located and how they're farmed, that do not, that really need some of this help, some of these additions, some of these processes. And those, yes, those ideally should be selling for a more moderate price, and maybe people that are paying the most moderate prices really don't care. And so there's a certain truth to that, but even a lot of people that can't afford more expensive wines are drinking some of those wines, and I think they would like to know what is in them.
Well, I'd certainly like to know that when I hold a glass of wine up to the light and I say to myself, wow, look at the beautiful color of that wine. Look at how extracted that wine is. I'd like to know that there's not mega purple in it.
Yes, we all would. And that's one that even in expensive wines, in a very careful degree, I'm afraid has been overused. As you know, it's a 2001 concentrate from ordinary grapes in the Central Valley that is added to these, quote, expensive wines.
Yeah. So what does the consumer do, and how do we get behind this idea of disclosure? You know, what's the best plan here?
Well, you know, again, I really think, and I really hope that the government, the feds, will allow voluntary ingredient labeling to go forward. They have really become insistent, for example, with us, because we do it, that absolutely everything we do has to be on that label if we're going to do anything. It has to be complete. And so we are very, very careful about that. But I think the consumers, if they care, should, you know, go to their favorite producers and say, you know, I'm a big fan of your wines. We should have more transparency. And I'm sure a number of them will gradually move in this voluntary direction.
I definitely hope it does go that direction, because it is a little frightening. You know, I've actually sat and listened to conversations with winemakers who've said, yeah, we dumped a gallon of acid into that. And I at least want to know that. And there's an awful lot of those ingredients that really are very harmless and have been used since the beginnings of winemaking. But there are other things that I think people would be astounded to learn are in their wine. And it's only fair to know that. And so we definitely, as a show, are going to continue to support this kind of disclosure, but more importantly, really want to salute you and Ridge for being at the forefront of doing what I think is really right in winemaking. Thank you so much, Paul.
You're very welcome, David. This has been a delight for me.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll talk again. But again, thank you for being at the helm of this. And we really appreciate you and all you've done for winemaking, and also the great wines that come out of Ridge.
Thanks very much.
All right. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
This is not just a wine show. This is Grape Encounters.
My heart is drenched in.
Now, back to Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
You know, today, you can walk into any big box wine store. There are thousands of wines there. It is incredibly difficult as a consumer to navigate those wine aisles, but it may be even more difficult for the person who you rely upon for advice to give you good advice, because certainly it's not even practical to think that anybody in one of the big box stores could actually drink all of those wines, let alone remember their particular nuances. Well, there's one person who I've known for a number of years now, who has made quite a name for herself as the publisher and editorial director of two major publications. One is called The Tasting Panel Magazine, which, if you want to dig deep into the stories behind winemakers and people who make liquors as well, this is the magazine to go to. It's an amazing publication. I read it from cover to cover every single month. And now she is the publisher of an incredible magazine called The Somme Journal, Journal. She took it over in June. Her name is Meredith May, and she's here in the studio with me, and I couldn't be happier about that.
Well, it's about time we got together, so I'm so happy.
No kidding, right?
Yeah. So I'm glad that we found the time today to talk, especially with the Psalm Journal now behind us.
Tell me the history of the Psalm Journal, because it's been around. It had a previous owner, right?
Right, right. It was around for 7 years. It was kind of an underground cult magazine with the Psalm community. Very geeky, go over your head kind of information for people who study for hours on end for certification, whether it be Court of Master Sommeliers or the WSET or many different kind of programs. So what happened was the man who owned it had a good concept, but he couldn't quite understand the idea of marketing it. So it went out of business. And it was defunct for about a year. And I have been hearing such great things about it. Many of my writers for Tasting Panel were actually penning stories. And I called the previous owner and made a deal, bought the name. And that was a year ago in December, and launched the first issue of Psalm Journal. It used to be called the Sommelier Journal. So launched it as the Psalm Journal, new name in June of this past year.
The word sommelier is out the door.
I think
it's seen better days.
That's
yeah, thanks
right.
to the movie Psalm, I guess. And it's amazing to me how many people have seen the movie Psalm, which would have been a movie for wine geeks only at one point in time. But I think just the everyday average person who drinks wine really is fascinated by how much there really is to know about wine as well.
I think so. Everybody used to want to rub elbows with all the celebrity chefs and bow to the chef. And now it's so easy to rub elbows with your Psalm. The fact that you can talk to people one-on-one where the chef is not as accessible
right.
makes it kind of a different animal.
So what has happened? I mean, obviously, there are tens of thousands of wines to choose from. And it really is true that it wasn't so long ago that there were only a handful. You could probably count the most popular wines on one hand.
Well, that's why Tasting Panel came into existence. It morphed out of a magazine called Patterson's Beverage
right,
Journal.
Right, exactly.
That in the back of the magazine had listings of all the brands that were available. Well, that couldn't exist. You'd have to have a phone book now. Bigger than a phone book. You'd have to have gigabytes online. There's not enough room to have a listing of every wine SKU that's out there in the world. But what's great about having the Tasting Panel is month after month after month, we're a platform for wineries. We're a platform for the buyers to make decisions, to understand more about who's behind the brand. What's the story behind the bottle?
Makes a big difference too. I think that the more somebody knows about the story behind the brand, the more likely they are to appreciate the brand.
There's individual stories to tell, and that's why we've been around for 8 years, month after month. And now we have 17 magazines to put out a year, and I'm overloaded with content.
So you can't squeeze it all into one magazine?
No, and I don't think I can.
It wouldn't be possible. But let's go back to this idea of the wine geek for a second. Have more and more of us become wine geeks? And are we doing it on purpose, or is it a necessity if you're going to be a wine lover in this world?
Yeah, I think we all want to be armed with some information so we can show our friends, our colleagues, that we know something about wine. But none of us can really be experts. I mean, that's hard to claim you're an expert. I interview the experts. Our writers meet the winemakers and the master sommeliers, masters of wine, top of the line. It takes a lot to really know what you're doing. And with all the experience you have judging and tasting and...
How often do you feel inadequate?
But I don't put myself in that position because I'm a magazine publisher and I provide a platform for the experts to tell their story.
That's a safe place to be.
Yeah, right?
It's amazing how many times I have not appreciated a wine and then suddenly liked it more after I got to know the person who made it.
Isn't that
It's true? A phenomenon.
Yes, it is. It really is. When you sit with a winemaker... especially at the winery or even at a wine dinner, wherever you are, and he or she is telling you these stories about what it took. So I write my tasting notes, but I always make sure that I have it with food. If I'm not sitting with the winemaker, I make sure there's food on the plate because I don't think it's fair to taste wines without some kind of accompaniment because it changes the profile so much.
Unless you just want to drink wine by itself.
That's okay too, but I'm talking about specifically when I'm reviewing.
Okay. So the challenge for somebody in the industry that's working in a wine shop, and we can hardly call them wine shops anymore because so many of the places that sell wine or liquor, they're so huge right now. You know, the Total Wines and Mores, the BevMo's, my goodness. What is a reasonable expectation of the person who's on the floor in a retail store?
Well, I think that's a great question because the smaller stores better darn well have knowledgeable people on the floor if they want to stay alive as a small neighborhood wine shop.
Right.
Either the owner should be there or a trained staff. Now, the chain stores, it's very difficult. I know Total Wine does some great radio commercials that talk about how they do have knowledgeable people on the floor. And I have gone into the stores and actually been surprised that they do. They know how to answer questions. If these stores don't have knowledgeable people, like a lot of the supermarkets don't.
They don't have any people.
You know, they say they have wine stewards. And
They don't even have shelf talkers.
That's true, huh?
Exactly. One of the things that I do like about a company like Total Wine and More is that their various people on the floor have their own favorites, and this will be Bill's favorite, and this will be Ginger's favorite, and so on. And, you know, once you spread the entire inventory out amongst all the staff members, there's a better chance that at least somebody in there is going to be familiar with that particular wine.
It reminds me of when we used to actually have bookstores, and you used to go in and see the recommendations by the staff,
yeah.
Bestsellers and all that. Now, a lot of the big stores, though, are forced to have aisle displays from some of the big wine companies, and some of the little guys get hidden, but they still make room for those little hidden gems, too. So it's always still good to ask someone's opinion. What's good? I'm looking for a Riesling. Then they should ask you, do you want a dry Riesling? Do you want a sweet Riesling? Do you want tightrope acidity? You know, they should know the right questions to ask. So the average consumer is not blindly searching for something.
We're talking to Meredith May. She's the publisher and editorial director of the Tasting Panel magazine. Awesome magazine.
Oh, thank you.
And the Somm Journal is for geeks, right?
It is. But anybody who's really interested in wine and wants to learn, we've got wine science stories. We have travel stories where we send writers all over the world with photographers to really capture the dirt. You know, what's going on? What's the latest trends in Turkey? We're trying to go to the ends of the earth and also close to home with our Somm camps, bringing the buyers to the different
regions. So you haven't talked about that. Tell me what a Somm camp is, and can I go to one?
Somm camp is for Somms, for wine buyers. You don't have to be a certified Somm, but it is an invitation only behind the scenes event that we handpick anywhere from 10 to 20 buyers.
So we had Paul Draper on a few minutes ago, and we're talking about full disclosure on wine labels. Mm-hmm. And the importance, I think, of that subject is the fact that while there are lots of amazing handmade wines with nothing added to it, except maybe some sulfites, there are other wines and a lot of wines now that have any number of things in them that we have previously been completely unaware of until people like Paul have brought it to our attention that all of these things are actually winding up in wine. Is that something that people are becoming more and more curious about, do you think? Or is their curiosity focused in a different way? The move toward SIP certified wineries, the movement toward organics, biodynamics. There was a time, I think, when nobody would have cared about that.
You know, I wonder about that. We did a story last issue on sustainability, biodynamics, organics, and I don't know if anyone really cares. I think it's very subjective. Some buyers will only buy a certain type of wine. The consumer, I don't know. I don't talk to the consumer. I think it's important to be sustainable and SIP certified because you're a steward for the land. So I think in the big picture, if it helps for the highest good, then it's good. But I don't know if it makes a difference in the wine.
Well, you're very much focused on the buyer, the person who's selling the wine.
Yes, we are 100% trade.
But of course, in order for them to do their job right, they need to know what the consumer wants to know. Do you have a sense of what the consumer wants to know? What do people want to know about wines and spirits? Where is their thirst, no pun intended? And what is it that the retailer wants to know that you can offer them?
Well, education is key. So not just marketing, blah, blah, blah. I think the retailer wants to know the real story. Don't BS me. Everyone just wants, what's the story in a nutshell? You know, bullet points, bullet points.
Is this all an outgrowth of living in an age where we have so much access to information?
Yes.
That the more information that we get, the more we hunger for further information?
Yes. And that's why I think our magazines are important, because they go into more depth than those bullet points. If you're in a classroom and you're teaching students about a subject and you have the time to teach them, then that's great. But when you walk into a store or you're sitting at dinner with someone and you want to order wine, you don't want to be completely versed.
There are a lot of people out there, consumers, who would probably be a lot happier if the only information they got was, it's good, it's very good, it's great, or it's terrible.
Well, too many, I think, rely on ratings, don't you? But that's our competition.
Well, you know, the challenge with wine is this. For the very same reason that some people paint their houses pink and other people go complain to the city that their neighbor's house is pink, we all have different tastes. My father still eats liver and onions. You'll never see me put that in my mouth. Never going to happen. Good and bad is so subjective. And don't you think that the person who is content and happy with their $2.49 bottle of wine and they love it and they can't wait to get home to drink it, I say to them, you don't need to learn anything more. If you're that happy with that,
oh, definitely.
Save yourself a bunch of money because you don't need to be drinking $80 wine.
No, exactly. That person's palate is happy drinking that or Coca-Cola. That's fine. But we're not talking to those people. And I think it's a completely different market. It's cartoons versus serious movies.
You know, it's been great having you here.
Thanks.
And for those who want to discover more about your publications, where do we send them?
Subscriptions at somjournal.com or subscriptions at tastingpanelmag.com. Now, we're free to the qualified trade. So if you do work in a retail wine store, anything in the hospitality industry, just let us know. Give us your name, title, address, and email. If you're not and you'd love to subscribe, it's $56 a year for Somm Journal and $36 a year for Tasting Panel.
$56. Heck, you know what? If you just make one good decision on a bottle of wine, it's worth it. It paid for itself, right?
It's tons of information and beautiful photography, I must say. We love to tell stories. And thank you, because you tell great stories too, David.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I hope you will come back again soon.
Love to.
And maybe we'll get into some of your favorite stories the next time we have you back in here.
Okay.
All right. Coming up next on Grape Encounters, it is the Grape Encounters news. Lots of crazy things going on in the world of wine. And we'll have that with our chief wine news correspondent, Larry Gifford, in just a moment. So stay with us. Or, well, you know what? As long as you don't go out of range of the radio, you can go refill your glass. But that's it.
While you're letting the wine breathe, Facebook us at facebook.com/Grape Encounters Radio.
Yesterday's news just hit home today.
Grape Encounters presents What We Heard Through the Grapevine. Today's top news, trends, and stories. Here's what we've encountered. This is Grape Encounters News.
And your Grape Encounter continues. And now time for the Grape Encounter News with Larry Gifford, our chief wine news correspondent. Tell you what, we could probably do 3 or 4 hours of Grape Encounters every week because there's so much news in the wine world. Don't you think, Larry?
Everybody's talking about wine. So much to talk about.
Especially this time of year.
Oh,
everybody's
yeah.
calling me going, what should I get as holiday presents? What Ooh. Should I give my boss? What should I give you, David Wilson? And if you
People
do,
are not asking what they should give you. Stop it.
Well, you will eventually. All right, let's jump into it. Go.
Speaking of buying wine, $8 billion. That's how much the world's ultra rich spent on wine and spirits in 2013.
You're saying a guy like Bill Gates spends $8 billion on wine?
No, not him alone. It's the entire ultra rich community.
Collectively?
Collectively.
Ah, that's nothing.
Really? Well, maybe to you, but to me, that's a lot of money.
What's ultra rich?
People that have the net worth of at least $30 million. Now, this survey was
Wait a second. If you and I pooled our resources, could we be on the list?
I don't think so. Unless you have 29,900,000.
All right. So that's what they spend on wine.
So, yeah. So it's a new survey from WealthX and UBS World Ultra Wealth. Wine and spirits accounts for 10% of their luxury goods expenses annually.
Here's the question, though. Are they enjoying it?
I bet they are. Who doesn't enjoy good wine?
I interviewed somebody earlier this year who supplies really amazing wines to those super yachts, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And she was telling me that, you know, a lot of times they bring these great wines aboard that people will order the most expensive thing that could be a $10,000 bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And they have no idea what they're even drinking.
Oh, isn't that a shame?
We may not be able to afford that wine, Larry, but we would appreciate it.
We would appreciate it.
All right, keep going.
French Wines with Style. It's a French wine tourism website, commissioned research to discover what your wine says about you. So for instance, David, red wine drinkers earn more money. They usually have a degree, their own home, and are more confident than those who sip white wine.
Wait a second. I'm mostly a red wine drinker, and I'm not on that list we were just talking about.
Well, it's not perfect. White wine fans are found to be better team players and the most generous, spending more on Christmas gifts for others than their red wine drinking counterparts. So here are some other red wine attributes. The red wine drinkers like to keep fit by cycling, gardening, and taking part in team sports.
That's me.
They prefer to go to the cinema.
That's me.
They're more likely to have a LinkedIn account.
I hate it.
And then when buying gifts, they're less thoughtful and more likely to just buy something.
Not true at all.
Okay.
I must be a white wine drinker.
I'm a red wine drinker, and that kind of fits me.
You know what your wine says about you, Larry?
I'm scared to ask.
No self-control.
That's true. That's true.
Save me!
So the white wine drinkers, David, are less likely to enjoy listening to music, reading, or exercise. I may be fitting on that list. Most likely to be found watching a live theater performance, and least likely to have a Facebook or Twitter account.
Least likely?
Yeah. And sparkling wine drinkers love reading, going for walks, socializing. Downton Abbey's their favorite TV show. And one in five 20-somethings favor sparkling wine. And sparkling fans consider themselves to be quirky and fun.
Well, for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
What about rosé?
Rosé, okay.
Oh, you have it.
I do.
I thought I was going to throw you a curveball.
No, they like clubbing and shopping, but also comfortable just sitting down in front of the TV at home. Most likely to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Vine regularly. Rosé drinkers are most likely to take a few weeks or even a month to pick the perfect gift. And they don't have children, but they want them in the future.
Well, they're not going to get them drinking rosé. I'm sorry. I like rosé.
I love a good rosé.
I have no children either.
You've introduced me to rosé. And I do have children.
I know, but she slapped you.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Okay.
So here at Grape Encounters, we're always looking to give new ways to play with wine.
Yes.
And here is a David Wilson-esque maverick idea for folks to try at home.
Okay. I can't wait.
So Barrington Coffee Roasting Company in Boston is offering side-by-side tastings of four wines and four different coffees.
Like it.
So the wines and coffees are from all over the world, but they pair them up to have a similar tasting experience. And if you think about people who taste wines, people who taste coffees, it's kind of interesting. They're both looking for tasting notes. They're both smelling the coffee or the wine for aromas. They're swirling their glass, and they let the liquid sit on their palate.
No. Who swirls their coffee?
Well, people who do coffee tasting.
They swirl their
– oh, yeah. Have you ever seen it?
In the tasting.
And then they
suck
it through their teeth.
Oh, that – what if you have sensitive teeth?
Well, then you wouldn't do that.
Okay. So when you say side by side, are you saying that you take a sip of wine and then a sip of coffee and
then
a sip of wine?
Yeah, so what they've done is they have like their own wine guy and their own coffee guy, and they teamed up. They're like, well, this one kind of is nutty and this one's kind of nutty. And so they were trying to match the wines and the coffees. It was kind of cool.
I like it.
Yeah, it's fun.
All right. Okay, next up.
There's a new app for your phone out there called Next Glass.
It's Next Glass.
Yeah, it's like a sommelier in your pocket. you sign in.
Is that a sommelier in your pocket, or are you just happy to have wine with me?
So you sign in and you create a profile by ranking different beers and wines from 1 to 4 stars. You do this 8 to 10 times with different wines or beers. And they say, okay, that's enough to get started. And the app figures out what you'll like based on the scientific analysis of the chemical compounds of the wines and beers that you rated.
It'll give me a wine name and I just rate that wine.
Yeah, so it'll show you the bottle. And
what
tell
if
you
I haven't
name.
Had the wine?
Well,
you skip it.
You skip it and go to the next
one. So you keep going until you find a wine that you've actually had.
Right. For me, it was BV and Penfold, Sterling, Woodbridge, DeLille, Camus, Liberty School. So some very familiar wines. So you flip through and the pictures of the labels and you rate them. And then you can also scan a bottle of wine. Like if you're at the liquor store or if you're at home, you scan the label with your phone.
Yeah.
And it captures it and it goes, oh, you know what? Based on what you've told us you like, this is a 93 for your palate, or this is an 87 for your palate.
Wow.
Which is really cool, except every bottle I tried, it didn't recognize. It wasn't in the app yet. They have 20,000 wines, but they didn't have the ones I had.
There are probably 40 billion wines in circulation, right. So I'll be waiting a little while to get the app.
Well, it's free, so you can get it now, and you can add to it. You can tell them, you know what, you need to add these wines.
I would think the wines you drink, Larry, would be very popular.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that's about it for the news today, Larry.
All right, David.
All right, nice having you in, Larry, and you know what? By the way, I'm glad you said that red wine drinker is not really all that generous.
Uh-oh. I fear this is not going to bear well for me.
Well, you'll understand, being a red wine drinker, why you don't get a present from me.
Being with you is a present.
Ah, that's right. Okay, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters for this week. We'll be back next week, same bat channel, with a sommelier in our pocket, just for you. We'll see you then.
Your grape encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.